Hello and welcome to the FinTech Newscast. My name's John, and this week we'll be talking about big changes in the peer-to-peer lending market in China. Silicon Valley takes a tour of China's FinTech world. Sweden goes well beyond implants in their quest to be cashless and high-tech. Capital One makes big investments into the FinTech world, and an overview of the payment space for FinTech. Please hit subscribe to keep up with these and the latest in FinTech news. Back after this. Oh, okay, that's like the level of trust.
That. Yeah.
So you adjust your...
But well, I would do more. I would do more if my wife let me, but I would do more.
Truth speaker.
Would you send $2,000 to someone in Venmo?
Yes.
Would you send $5,000 to someone in Venmo?
I would send an unlimited amount of it because I've used it so much that it's built that trust already.
So you'd put down a deposit on your house
on Venmo?
With Venmo.
No, because I don't think they would accept it.
So not an unlimited amount.
But you
not
you
unlimited amount, yeah. An unlimited like personal spending amount, not like a household spending amount.
All right, let's get started with some interesting articles. A lot of good stuff this week. With me is Monica.
Hey, John.
And Steve.
Heidi-ho.
All right, there's these crazy things happening in China right now around peer-to-peer lending. You know, they have, the government there has the option to just change direction on a whim. So this is something that they're doing with the peer-to-peer lending market. They feel like it's gotten overly frothy, which is fair, and too risky for a lot of individual investors, especially that have put money into it. And causing volatility in a heating market. So what the government's done is they're saying they're going to put all these new regulations on peer-to-peer lenders. And this has been happening for, well, all of this year, pretty much. A little bit last year, they started with some light regulation, and now they're really clamping down with higher and higher requirements. So it's expected that they'll go from more than 1,500 peer-to-peer lenders. So basically, everyone and their mother has jumped into this game.
That is an insane amount of
easy money, I think, right? It's a new market and funded by individual investors for the most part. So people are putting, in some cases, their life savings at risk for something that's not regulated. You know, sounds like a good return, not quite a quick, rich scheme, but people are assuming that these are government-backed companies when it's just, if there's 1,500, a lot of these are just people out of their garage and stuff like that with no capital backing. So they want to cut it down to around 50 peer-to-peer lenders over the next 12 months.
How do they decide which lenders get to be on the offer?
Well, that's why they're setting
the winnowing process.
They're setting very high requirements. So you have to have a certain millions of dollars of capital. You have to have certain infrastructure in place. And so they estimate that only about 50 players will have the resources to meet these higher requirements.
And so the government will just force those organizations that don't meet the requirements to just shut down?
Yeah, pretty much. And this is causing a big problem for the investors in these companies because the ones running these peer-to-peer lenders, in some cases, are just making off with the money and leaving the country. So because of that, they're restricting people that work in the peer-to-peer lending industry from leaving the country.
Jesus.
So you can't leave the country if you're in this business right now.
Is this related to the credit social risk scoring system they have in China? And how do they actually enforce the restrictions on your leaving the country if you do run a P2P company?
Oh, well, the restriction on leaving the country is easy. Yeah, they tag you. They have database. You know, they're much more closely
much
watching.
Much more centralized security state.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like saying, how did you not leave the Soviet Union?
Right.
They said no. So that's pretty straightforward. The social ranking system, I don't think it's related. It's more that they want to restrict too much lending. They have very high debt levels. They've come down on some of the cities and provinces on over borrowing for infrastructure projects or just building up their state-owned or supporting, propping up their state-owned enterprises. So it's more to do with that and controlling that lending. A lot of those cities and provinces, by the way, go ahead and borrow anyway. Right. And they're not always following what the central government. So there's some carrots and sticks involved.
What I find interesting here is that the Chinese government, like all governments, looks to find kind of somebody else to blame when they do something that's unpopular. And I'm wondering what their plan is here, because this seems like a great way to be in the news for all the wrong reasons, right? You're actively looking to shut these companies down when you know that people have their life savings tied up in them.
So, of course, what happens? Major protests. So all through this year, there have been protests of hundreds of thousands of people involved over the year against these kinds of measures. And so for some protection for their losses that they're actually experiencing. So besides credit default losses, there's the fraud that we talked about.
Mm.
And, you know, the funds getting tied up, you know, people making excuses, people trying to escape from the country.
Mm-hmm.
So there have been protests, and any kind of protest, even if it's pretty much justified and kind of in keeping with the government policy of shutting down this kind of these businesses, is still frowned upon. You can't protest. The only thing you can protest is against the United States or Japan,
mm-hmm.
or for Xi Jinping. If it's one of those three, you can protest. You can have as many people as you want. Anything else, if it's against construction or what we call eminent domain in the U.S., taking of property, then it's not the police have a huge presence. So one of
but
the
people are doing it anyway.
But right. People do it anyway. Yes. China is not shy. Our Chinese people are not shy about showing their displeasure at government policies or unfair practices that happen, or other policies that hurt them. So they go out. There have been many protests with regard to this, because people's money is on the line. So, of course, passions are going to run high. So one of the protesters who invested in a peer-to-peer lender, she said she was surprised when she showed up to speak out against these peer-to-peer lenders and these policies that were going to hurt her. And because she thought she was in line with the government, and there was tons of police there, and so she was shocked, and they ended up taking her away when she tried to explain what the problem was.
Yikes. Mm.
So not super open, but
who was expecting that?
Yeah. So China is still pretty much hard line when they want something to happen. So I hope you don't have much money in peer-to-peer lenders in China, unless it's the top 50 or so. Then you might be okay.
I mean, unless it's in a international fund that I have, I don't know
right.
about it.
yeah, probably not. But yeah, this always happens, right? When an economy grows very quickly, there's always big gaps in regulation and things that never happened before. And this is just one of those things when you're in a growing economy where it's just going to need to develop the regulations, the rules, the protections. For consumers, for borrowers and investors.
And certainly we've even seen in our financial crisis 10 years ago that people have an expectation of things being backed by the government that in fact are not. And that is incredibly problematic. It just creates a real risk in the marketplace.
That's the other thing. People forget. If there hasn't been a crash for a while, people assume it's never going to happen. It's never happened in my lifetime. So we have to keep reminding ourselves. All right, for the next article, we're going to take a little tech tour of China.
Yeah, so the New York Times has an article out this week about how kind of a delegation of some venture funds and Silicon Valley Bank kind of got a junket together and decided to tour some of the major cities and locations in China's tech scene. And the article is fairly entertaining for a number of reasons, one of which is just kind of the level by which the American-based visitors, certainly they're not all necessarily Americans, but they do work in Silicon Valley, how shocked they were by the hard-working, hard-driving culture in China's tech scene. And one of the rubrics that everybody, or the mantras that everybody shares, is the 996. And that's you work from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. 6 days a week.
Just yeah. Oh, why? Wow. Yeah.
Oh,
right.
Yeah.
I'm going to go to
Utopia.
China.
And I thought that was interesting because certainly, you know.
Well, with all the overtime you make.
Yeah.
then it's certainly worth it. I mean,
yeah. I mean, there are people here in Silicon Valley who are working those kinds of hours too. And I think that it's maybe not quite as glorified as it used to be, and you wouldn't have necessarily your moniker for it. But so anyway, folks are working really hard. And a couple of other things that they were really struck by, because of the completely different kind of government
historical cultural
context in which China's tech scene is coming up in. And I do want to be clear that I wouldn't say that our tech scene is so ahead of it. It's just we're a few news cycles ahead of it. Mm-hmm. There is really no evaluation given to, oh, what are the ethics of what we're building? What are the worst case scenarios of the things that we are building? You know, how close, how in bed do we want to be with government? You know, what are some of the less positive ramifications of facial recognition, which is used all over China in all kinds of contexts in ways that would probably be quite shocking to us. It certainly sounds like it was quite shocking to these delegates. So there's kind of like this furious race to build things and not necessarily a cultural thoughtfulness around what's it going to be in the end.
So 1984 isn't required reading in high school over there?
Probably not. Most definitely not.
Because
we've been scared here in the West, right? We've always had this. Even before these things were possible, we had warnings about it. Cameras watching you everywhere. Right. That this was a bad thing.
Yeah.
Even from the 40s,
and,
right?
And we have a very different cultural idea about privacy, I think.
Kind of anti-Soviet
Union, maybe?
I think people
here sort of tend to focus on, like, fulfillment and the things to do at work and how it makes you a better person. And
selfish individualism,
exactly,
some people might
I
say.
A lot less of that in China, from the lens of this article, at least.
Yeah.
It's also interesting because here they also pointed out that in a lot of companies here in the Valley, especially the big ones, you can devote, say, 20% of your time to working on your special project.
Mm-hmm.
Not so much in China. In China, it's like, that's your job.
They mentioned it as one of the negatives of that system.
Right.
There's no creativity.
There's no creativity,
And it's not, and I know this from some of my own professional career, it's not a place where, you know, you can kind of burble ideas up from the bottom. Like, that is just, like, what are you even thinking?
It's just all top down.
And, you know, there are pros and cons to that, right? Like, you can move really fast on a plan that the executives have decided it's really important to execute on when you don't have people thinking, oh, no, but I want to tell you about my great idea.
Right.
But, of course, sometimes you do miss out on those great ideas. So, anyway, a short article worth reading.
One thing they didn't mention, though, was, like, the treatment of women in the workplace. I see is, you know, it's come up in other articles, but one of those cultural differences or, you know, you have to develop it in your own context, in your own culture, and it takes time. Women are not always treated fairly, or sometimes they hire based purely on appearance to make their office more attractive to other workers.
I've been to VC stuff.
I think there are lots of developing countries where there tends to be more
Never happens here.
There are more senior women at higher ranks in many different countries and industries than there are in America. So there are some things that show that kind of countries that maybe don't put as much emphasis on egalitarianism as kind of a cultural ethos, nonetheless have a more egalitarian workplace. So they don't talk about it in this article, you're right, but I've read a number of different things that make me think it might not be the same in terms of how it plays out.
Yeah, they do mention that when Google was starting out, they had people speaking 40 different languages or, you know, diverse, and whereas the Chinese tech companies tend to be more
homogenous.
Yeah, they are developing within a monoculture, and part of that is because certainly a big bulk of Chinese culture is very homogenous. And it's such a huge market that you can get away with it, right? You know,
exactly,
if you're building things for 1.5 billion people, you know, that ain't like living in Liechtenstein.
A really interesting article. And it really points out that they're working really hard and building so many new things. It's not just all about the cultural differences. Their technology is developing very, very quickly.
And part of that is because of the lack of regulations or concerns about privacy. And so some of the leaders in this space get huge data sets that can really be used to power their artificial intelligence applications in a way that may put the U.S. And Europe behind the eight ball. We'll see.
Yeah, and help the government track you at the same time. But that don't think about that.
Don't worry about that.
Yeah, that's all good. It's all for the motherland. Well, speaking of countries going leaping forward in technology, Sweden's been doing something really interesting.
This is a great story.
This is very fun. But not for me. So we've got microchips. We've got skin. We've got Sweden. NPR did an article this week around how a pretty substantial but small portion of the Swedish population is voluntarily having a tiny little microchip inserted via a hypodermic needle into their finger, and they are using it to ease the friction in their daily lives.
Isn't that a sign of the beast, by the way? Being microchipped, and right?
Everyone's assigned a number.
Yeah,
I mean, I think in different times in history, everything has been a sign of the beast if you didn't like it.
Right, right.
So if you've got $180 and you're willing to do this, you can have this little microchip about the size of a grain of rice. It's put into the skin just above your thumb, and about 4,000 Swedes have already opted into this. Now, why would they do this? Well, you can actually then use your thumb or the microchip inside your thumb as a way to open up your home, to get into your office, to
ATM machine?
Into the gym. They didn't mention that one, but I don't think it's too far off. You can also store your emergency contact details, social media profiles, or what about e-tickets for an event? So think of all the times you've been like furiously trying to pull up your Eventbrite ticket or whatever it is.
And
like,
running.
Oh, God, Ticketmaster.
I got a Bon Jovi.
Oh,
I'm
I don't
late.
Have a great connection. Oh, and you can also use it for rail journeys within Sweden.
Oh, very
on
cool.
On their rail system. So this is, you know, certainly something that I think we can expect to see a lot more of. And one of the things that the article explores a little bit is, well, why would this be taking off in Sweden? And there are a few theories, but certainly the country has a long history of embracing new tech. And so this could be seen just as the next step there. And it's also already been moving very quickly towards being a cashless society. So the article states that only 1 in 4 Swedes performs a cash transaction within any given week. So they're already moving away from kind of the traditional wallet. And it is also a country that has relatively high levels of trust for the government, for the banks, for kind of
their institutions.
The old school institutions. And that may make
corruption.
People a lot more comfortable taking this step.
So who's doing this? Is this like a standard communication protocol that all the companies are doing? Or is it one company pushing it or the government? Or
You know, I'm not sure that the article necessarily specifies, but it sounds like there are lots of different vendors who are kind of offering this service. They specifically...
Oh, they must be on a standard protocol then.
Yeah, they specifically talk about, talk with a couple of people, one of whom, you know, uses it to open up the lock to a 16th century apartment.
They install the digital lock.
Yeah. And another gal who has her LinkedIn details on it. And so when she goes to networking events, she when she wants to share her info, you know, she just has the person that she's meeting, they pull up a certain web page and she holds her finger near the phone and it completely updates.
So you can pretend you're a wizard.
So
you can
what's
pretend
the tech?
You're a wizard.
Is this like a Bluetooth or an NFC? It's not Bluetooth.
It's NFC.
Powered. It's probably, yeah, the NFC.
Yeah, they
Thanks,
mentioned that.
John.
Yeah.
So what are the negatives? Why wouldn't I want to have this if it's so convenient?
Well, you know, I think it depends on what info you have on there. One of the things that they do call out in this article is that as health data becomes more prevalently stored on these kinds of things, you know, then you're looking at the possibility of having your health data captured, hacked, transmitted in ways that you would not like. And, you know, I mean, I think we as a global society, much less national societies, have a lot to think about in terms of what is the new private?
Right.
What does it look like? What are things that we want to keep to ourselves and what don't we? You know, what you've already got the stat running around that, you know, if you are for the most part white in America, you know, your third cousin's DNA is already publicly available. So, you know, your genome is basically identifiable, even if you've never had a DNA test.
If they can, if they have enough pieces of the puzzle, they can figure you out.
They do. I think that's how they caught the.
That's how they caught the Golden State Killer.
Thank you. Yeah,
and
by his cousin's
DNA.
How
they caught Bay Area rapist just recently, who you know worked at Berkeley.
So if you want to commit any crimes, please tell your family not to get DNA tests.
I think it's
too late. We're talking about third cousins.
It's already
people
it's already
you've
done.
Never met. So if you want to commit crimes, and you shouldn't, but if you do, you need to not leave your DNA.
Yeah. Okay. DNA okay, Dexter.
Right. You heard it here first.
And that is your crime tip of the week. Never leave DNA behind.
Yeah. All right. So let's get back to the U.S. Are there any big banks doing anything interesting here?
There are always some big banks doing some interesting things. And this week, the Wall Street Journal interviews Capital One's chief information officer. His name is Rob Alexander. And this is a good opportunity for him to get a little bit of log rolling and recruiting in for tech talent.
Yeah.
So
sponsorship opportunity still available.
Yes, absolutely, Rob. So some of the things that that they talk about in this interview. So Capital One has expanded their tech staff from 2,500 to 9,000 people since 2011.
That's what I like to see. Put your money where your mouth is. Everybody says we're tech, we're innovative, but when you hire, when you have 9,000 people on it.
When you're more than tripling your tech staff.
I believe you.
And this includes software engineers, developers, and a lot of artificial intelligence experts.
And finger implant technicians.
Not so much specified that. So what they've really also been doing, in addition to the hiring, they've done a couple of big initiatives. One has been to really move the bank's back-end software development tools and infrastructure to the public cloud. And that is a really kind of interesting thing for banks to do.
Would they
banks,
be using Red Hat software for that?
Well, I don't know.
Just they, acquired by IBM?
They didn't say in this particular article, and I don't have enough knowledge about what they do. But, you know, banks have a real kind of red-in tendency to kind of do things in their own closed systems because that's really how they had to run for decades. But using the public cloud, they can get new software products to market faster. They can still use really high-end security, which is important as well.
Standardizing their data would be a big help, right?
Oh, God, yeah. So the other thing that they talk quite a bit about in the interview is their efforts on customer-facing chatbots. Mm-hmm. And theirs is named Eno. That's how I'm saying it. I mean, if people would tell me if their things are phonetic or not, I wouldn't always have to say, am I saying it right? But we're going to call it, I'm going to call it Eno.
I think I figured out, by the way, I figured out the naming convention for chatbots for banks. So Bank of America is Erica.
Erica.
I finally got that.
I saw that when I saw Bank of America on the sign.
Yeah, yeah.
I was so embarrassed.
And Eno is Capital One, O-N-E, backwards.
Backwards.
Whoa, just blew your mind.
God, you did blow my mind.
I did.
And what they do say is that they specifically decided Eno to be gender neutral, and they did that with the help of, you know, filmmakers, anthropologists, journalists, and designers, because they wanted deep expertise in character development to kind of give this chatbot a little bit of a personality, but maybe not so much of a personality that it was gendered.
I like seeing bank executives admit that they're not good at something and bringing in expert help to do it.
Yes, and I also think that it's really emphasizing how important some of those human elements are to a pleasant and productive customer interaction. So, one of the things that they, that Rob, because he and I are totally on a first name basis now.
Mr. Alexander to you,
Mr. Alexander goes into some detail around some of the struggles that they had as they started to build this chatbot. So one of the things they realized fairly early on is that these bots, they have to be very good for customers to be willing to use them. And I say that from personal experience because I'll just like close that little chatbot box and get on the phone. And I don't care
first
if I have
impressions
to be on hold for a half hour while I unload the dishwasher. Yeah. I'm not dealing with that chatbot if it sucks. So anyway.
It's also easier at times to just navigate through stuff as opposed to like having to dictate, like whatever, transfer money. It's just cheaper, easier to just put do it with your thumbs. It's faster as well. So I heard from somebody from B of A recently that their uptake on Erica, their chatbot, is less than 1%.
What?
So less than 1% of customers actually use Erica to do any sort of basic function.
Well, was it beta? Or because those ads just started coming out, right?
It's been out for like 3-4 months or so in some markets.
Oh, 3 or 4 months.
And now it's deployed nationwide. But yeah, it's less than 1%. So
that's interesting. So Mr. Alexander talks about this a little bit more in depth. He said that, you know, your bots really have to understand the intent of the customer's interaction, as well as have the functionality to execute whatever the customer wants. Mm-hmm. And that first one is actually pretty darn hard. And he talks a little bit about they realize that there are about 2,500 ways for a customer to request her balance. Like, you know,
2,500 ways?
Show me my balance.
Oh,
how much
wordings.
Money do I have in my account?
Really?
How much spending have I racked up in the last month? You know, whatever it is. So you have to have like a really high degree of sophisticated natural language processing just to be able to understand, wait, what did this person even ask of me? Because it's very easy to build a bot that can tell you what your balance is once it knows that's what you want. But getting it to know what you want is actually really hard. Mm. So they've spent a ton of time and built that huge team with all kinds of interdisciplinary expertises.
Anthropologists, neurologists, archaeologists,
podiatrists.
Everybody's been involved.
And part of the reason that I think this interview is good log rolling is that Capital One sees themselves absolutely explicitly as competing against some of the top technology
but
teams in the world
all,
for their talent.
That. They all say that, though, right?
Yes.
Lloyd Blankfein.
That's why it's good log rolling, right?
This
right.
Did he say that they think of themselves as a tech company?
I think both Jamie Dimon and Lloyd Blankfein have both at some point said we're a tech company. Like, we have to hire engineers and not so much bankers anymore.
So Capital
One.
Oh,
yeah, you have to have coding now for a lot of the well, this is the Wall Street trading kind of area.
At least SQL, yeah.
So yeah, yeah.
Capital One is on the record as saying that they actually benchmark against the Facebooks, the Amazons, the Netflix in terms of their pay, the level of work that they're offering people. So, you know, it's a good way for Mr. Alexander.
So they laid off a bunch of people in their risk management to take care, to hire in the tech side. So
that's undocumented. John made that
up. Remember Capital One? That's way back when. No, they'd be out of business. So let's get to the big picture. And the big picture this week is on payments.
Right. So question for you guys. Say you go to a store. Say you go to your
local Starbucks. Okay, I'm at a store.
You're at a store. You have your credit card
Starbucks
out.
Is a store?
Okay. Sure, it's a shop.
Sure.
And you drop $100. How much of that do you think will actually go to Starbucks? Of the $100.
Oh, they probably have a good deal with their credit card people,
maybe
right?
Maybe that's not a good example. Let's say your local mom and shop. Whatever. So you go to Ace Hardware and you go swipe your card and you drop $100.
Oh, okay. Then it's like
they get 98.
They get
like three. They'll probably pay like 3 point. Square is like 2.75, unless you have a certain volume, like over at least 100,000,
right?
Annually, and then it'll go down to two and a half. Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, so it's actually so for the average merchant, they get approximately $97 out of every $100 that you spend at the store. Who's taking that money, right? You may ask yourself, who is getting a slice of that pie? And basically, there's a whole five-party system. Not you, not me, not the merchant. Who's inserting themselves into this whole process here? And there's what they call the four-party system. So essentially, the issuing bank, which is your local bank, your B of A, your Chase, whatever, will both do the credit underwriting and give you the credit card and the actual physical card. You go to the store, you swipe your card. Once you swipe your card, however, there's a whole bunch of layers of people, of companies and entities that kind of take a slice of the pie. One of them is the payment processor. So that's your Adyen, which we talked about a few weeks ago here. They're the Dutch payments processing company. There's Stripe as well, if you do stuff online. Then you follow that up with the payment rail, so like the Visa and MasterCards of the world. And then follow the next step of that is actually then the acquiring bank. So like the merchant's bank also has to pay a fee. So that means that, you know, from that $100, about $3 or so is divided between all those players. And we're seeing a lot of movement in that space to kind of consolidate and shift those relationships. And a lot of the
sounds like room for efficiency, yeah.
Exactly. And a lot of the new players are sort of inserting themselves in the process and even going upstream or downstream.
Yeah, I was wondering why payments is getting so much funding, and you've kind of laid out the problem.
There's
the high cost.
And it's very high cost. It's the reason why Square is so successful, as well as Stripe and adding in the companies that we'll go over, PayPal as well, Venmo. But it's basically a space where you can, if you insert yourselves, even though it's low dollar amounts, the volumes more than make up for that. And thus you have companies with like $20 billion valuation based on their small piece of the pie in that payment sequence, basically. So if you can make $0.03.
Venmo's going to make it up in volume.
That's the argument. Yeah, that's the argument. So there's been a couple of really interesting M&A activities in the past. One of them is that PayPal acquired iZettle. Which is a company that basically will do point of sale payments. So now they want to deploy their own like Square type thing, so they can go to a store and tap or swipe your card with an iZettle machine. That means that two of those steps that I mentioned before will be contracted into one company. So now PayPal can maybe acquire or capture more of that payment fee now as well. We also saw that Square acquired Weebly a few weeks ago for $366 million.
Weebly,
yeah, W-E-E-B-L-I. And Weebly is a company that will give merchants the ability to sell stuff on and offline. So now if you're online, you may have to use Stripe or something to for your payments, and then maybe Square for like your physical POS. With Weebly, you can do one platform at a reduced rate. So they're moving upstream now from the processing to actually capturing the payments. The other is that now Stripe also acquired a company called Index, which again will kind of help companies accept payments both on and offline. So we see a lot of movement in this space,
such a difference between on and offline payment service. You'd need different functionality, I guess, right?
Like, you do.
Not just the hardware.
Yeah, it all tends to run on the Visa or MasterCard rails, but there's definitely a lot of, it's a different process to do what they call card present stuff versus card not present stuff. So card present is at the store in person. CNP is stuff that you buy online. Right.
I would imagine like the fraud protocols are different.
Very, very different.
And if you're a relatively small business, wouldn't you rather just have one contract to handle all of your credit card payments rather than two?
Instead of having five players kind of take a slice of your pie, just give a smaller slice of your pie to one player.
And you're not getting the cheaper rates if your volumes are getting split in two,
that's
right?
True as well.
You wouldn't do that as well. Yeah, that's right. So that's sort of on the domestic payment side. On the sort of cross-border payment side, we've seen a lot of movement in that space as well. So I saw recently that TransferWise, sort of the cross-border payment company, they claim that by next year, 2019, they will overtake Western Union in total transaction volumes.
Where's TransferWise from?
I think they're in the UK.
Okay.
Pretty sure they're in the UK. And Western Union, of course, has been around since like 1851
forever.
Or so, forever, right? They started off as like transporting
horses,
like, gold, essentially, and have sort of a very staid traditional product. But now they're getting a lot of their volume being taken away by TransferWise. Even though, if you look at the numbers, of course, it'll take a while for TransferWise to catch up with Western Union. Mm-hmm. It's still, given the fact that TransferWise started maybe like 4 years ago or so, the fact that they've been able to almost match the transactions that Western Union has completed is pretty incredible.
They must have a much lower fee.
They do. They have a little bit of a lower fee. It's more more efficient. You can do it from your desktop, which I don't think you can with Western Union. Maybe not.
They're in person.
They're in person. Like you have to go to the store and do the whole paperwork stuff. Now these guys, TransferWise, can just do it on your phone or on your computer, which is a better experience.
Yeah, there's so many competitors coming after Western Union. I'd be kind of surprised if they were not really bleeding badly or going away.
Apparently they're doing not so bad. Apparently they're doing pretty well given the competition, especially in the cross-border payment space.
That's what they always
say
totally disrupted.
It happens slowly than all at once.
There is a big difference between still making money and growing.
Right.
Western Union has tons of infrastructure. They're all over the world. People know their name. That's
and
not
still,
worth
TransferWise
nothing.
Wise almost matched their transaction. That's all Western Union's lost revenue, right?
Right.
Maybe, maybe not. Like, TransferWise could be creating capacity in the market for
or at
people
least partially
who would not
then.
Otherwise
yeah.
have transferred money.
I know, I said that and I was like,
Yeah. I mean, I'm not saying Western Union's in a great position. I'm just saying that, like, it's like newspapers, you know? Like, there are not as many newspapers. They are not the cash cows they once were, but newspapers exist.
Right.
There's a fintech that's probably hasn't existed yet that will buy out Western Union sometime down the road.
What's interesting is that actually their volumes are pretty steady, and their product is apparently somewhat competitive in the marketplace. It's just that they're steady, whereas everyone else is really growing tremendously. Also, John, this is more for you.
Yes.
Apparently, all these sort of hyped blockchain and DLT-based companies barely made a dent in cross-border payments. It's basically not even a blip in the radar.
What do they say? All hat, no cowboy.
It's also kind of putting complexity where... it's already complex enough, you know? Taking, like, hi, here's my $800. Can you get it to this other country and convert it into that local currency? Let's just call that as complex enough.
Right. No more blockchain DLT stuff.
We don't need to Ripple it up.
Yeah, exactly.
Sorry, Ripple. You might not.
It's also interesting because there's been a lot of activity also in the market in terms of funding. So I think we talked about last week about Berkshire Hathaway investing in Paytm, but then we also have Amazon Pay in India for like P2P payments, also like POS payments. We have Ant Financial kind of putting their tentacles all over Asia with both Alipay, but also KakaoTalk and other players like Line in Japan. I think you have Line, right?
Yeah.
So all that stuff. And then we also saw the release of a few months ago of WhatsApp Pay. So WhatsApp is tremendously popular in India. But up until a few months ago, you couldn't do payments. Now you can do P2P payments with WhatsApp nowadays.
Facebook got to make that money.
They got to monetize. So those two guys left because they felt like there was no alignment between their priorities and Facebook,
they left,
right?
Because they had been promised that WhatsApp would never charge for messages.
Or they wouldn't use their user's data for advertising
and
all that stuff.
Yeah.
And who else? Yeah. And who knows what else that they saw going on there?
Yeah. But anyway, a really interesting space. I think we should do sort of a recurring segment on payments and what's going on there, because I think there's a lot of great movement in that space right now, both domestic and international. So much money as well. There's Veeam, which raised $25 million from Goldman Sachs. I won't leave that in. But yeah, there's just all these people are just raising money hand over fist.
And stuff like that,
yeah.
Well, I mean, if, you know, 3% or so of every credit transaction that's done is at play, that is a lot of money.
Yeah, they will make it up in volume.
And now it's time for our final bite, where we take a look at a number and the fascinating story behind it. So my final bite is $15 million. That's the amount that Dapper Labs, and I love that name, Dapper. Maybe we should use that word more. Dapper Labs, they're the creator of CryptoKitties, the most used blockchain distributed application in the world.
Which is not saying much.
Which is not saying much. It's still not very much, right? At 6 transactions per second or something like that.
It's no Visa. Right.
Among Canadians.
Right. Yeah, that's right. They're based in Canada, and they're going to use this money to expand their operations. They're going to open up a U.S. headquarters office and expand into other services to make their DLT applications work more smoothly and more efficiently. Mm-hmm. And so that's based on the Ethereum blockchain, which is going to have a big software upgrade next year, early next year, to speed up transactions and efficiency and change from proof of work to proof of stake. So a lot of things should help Dapper Labs. And I just got that, DAP, Distributed Application Dapper.
Oh, cool.
I got it.
All right.
So many minds being blown today. Yeah, I love it.
Dapper, Distributed Application, right. Okay. So they're expanding, and it's kind of interesting, the investors that they got. So the Rockefellers, famously known as being very, very wealthy for a long, long time.
They will drink a milkshake, yeah?
Yeah, is that based on him?
I think it is, yeah.
Ah,
or was it Getty? I think it was Getty.
I
don't even know what we're talking about.
Who's the guy in
it? There Will Be Blood.
What's the museum in L.A.?
I haven't watched it. I'm afraid of
that's the Getty.
Oh, it's so good.
There's the Getty Center and the Getty Villa.
The Getty Museum. So I think it's based on Getty. Sorry, not Rockefeller. A different Robert Baron.
Yeah. I think they softened him up in the movie.
A totally different hardcore moneymaker.
Yeah.
Yeah. And all the crimes.
Either of whom would drink your milkshake.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And all the crimes involved in getting to that. What's it? Between every great... thing be, digit
behind every, I don't know, but he is meeting every great
fortune.
Yeah. Yeah.
Damn it. Yeah, of course. Behind every great fortune is a great crime, or many, many, many crimes.
Yeah. In the case of them.
Anyways, Venrock is the official venture capital arm of the Rockefeller family, who's putting money into Dapper Labs and looking forward into the future. So that must be why they're still rich. All right. Steve, what's up?
Good number, John. Good number.
Thank you.
Speaking of what's up, my number is a little higher. It's a little lower than that. It's actually only $68,000. And that is the amount of money that fraudsters were able to steal from customers of Fifth Third Bank, which is a regional bank in the Midwest, by exploiting their cardless ATM function. So essentially, this is kind of an old phishing scam with a new skin on it, but they would text customers saying, hey, we're your bank, we're Fifth Third Bank in Illinois, Ohio, and Michigan, whatever. Your account has been compromised. Click on this link, give us your credentials. Once they have their credentials, they can then go log in onto your bank and spoof your SIM card to receive a text message, and then go to the ATM with no card, just your phone, and withdraw all your funds. Mind you, it's a very small amount of money, only again $68,000, but it's kind of sort of a it's a new take on an old scam, and I think that it may become more widespread as we see more banks embrace this new cardless ATM thing. So I know Chase has it, Wells Fargo has it as well. But yeah, watch out, and for Christ's sakes, if you get a text from your bank, do not click on the link.
As usual, it's the human element of the security.
That's the weakest link.
Never
that's the
give
weakest
your
link.
PIN. Yeah.
Never give your PIN.
Never give your PIN.
You should tattoo that on your forehead, yeah.
The PIN, or?
Just your PIN.
You need to tattoo it backwards so you can read it in the mirror.
The last four in your PIN.
Those websites they mock up, and the emails look exactly like your bank. I mean, there's been times where I've almost clicked on something. I'm like, wait a second.
You and John Podesta.
What am I doing?
Yeah. Exactly, yeah. But I think there are ways to tell.
But I'm so frightened of that I mean, I always check where the email address is coming from.
Right.
It's going to say, like,
Moscow.bankofamerica.com.
Right.
They'll work in the name of the institution, but there'll be some weird thing. It's under a different top URL.
Or even the URL you click on will be maybe have a letter off, or like they'll change a letter for a number, like a 4 for an 8 or something. So yeah, just be very vigilant. Do not give your PIN. And if you get a quote unquote text from your bank, call your bank, call the number on the back of your card. Yeah. Don't call that number.
Be careful, kids.
And that's our PSA for the week.
Thanks, Steve.
Well, speaking of being careful, I received a letter from my bank this week, and the letter was all about a change.
The letter R.
The letter was all about the change in terms of service with their Zelle service. And they went to great pains to let me know that I should only send money through Zelle to someone I know and trust.
But wouldn't you do that anyway?
Well, maybe yes, maybe no. And the reason I should only do that is because if I missend money or send it to someone who I don't know or trust, I've got no way to get that money back. So my final bite is zero. And that's exactly how much protection you're getting from your bank when you use Zelle. So...
Oh, I thought that's how much you were going to use Zelle is zero.
No, I'll still use it, and I do find it handy.
It's quite useful.
I do find it handy to send money to friends. But I find this interesting because I think that one of the strengths that banks have over, or at least a perception that the strength that banks have over some of their upstart competitors is that they do provide more coverage against fraud and misuse. And certainly that does not seem to be the place that they're going for with Zelle. So if you think about if your debit card number is stolen, you know, you're typically liable for the first $50 of spending, and then after that your bank will cover it. Or I just got charged on a credit card. I just had to charge for auto parts in Brazil. And I was like,
what were you doing in Brazil, Monica?
Never having been to Brazil and certainly not needing auto parts while there, I, of course, called my credit card company, and they were really great about reversing the charge and canceling the card. But you're not going to get that kind of service with Zelle. So buyer beware.
Wow, some great warnings here. And also, spend all you want on CryptoKitties. All right. That's it for this episode of the FinTech Newscast. If you have any questions, comments, or would like us to discuss any topics, please feel free to email us at info@fintechnewscast.com. Please hit subscribe to keep up with the latest episodes. And thanks for listening.
Thanks again.
I hope you voted.